Welcome to episode 151 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including lit RPGs. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uessa. Hello, Daniel. It's been a long time.
Yes, yeah, we haven't had much time to actually catch up in, like, the two of us before recording here. So, live report on how our respective summers have been, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, we've been off the air for about, I don't know, close to 2 months. We've been summer vacation here in North America, of course. And I was gallivanting in a couple of different countries. You're busy yourself, so I guess let's catch up on a little bit. Maybe we can remind people that normally we do like a kind of like a three-segment setup. We have light, what's been going on in our lives and industry sort of thing in the appetizer. We cover more meaty games that we've been playing in the main section. And then we cover kind of off-topic stuff that we've been getting up to in the dessert. But we might be varying slightly from that planned structure for this one.
Yeah, I don't think the three-course structure is going to be changing too much broadly. The one thing it is changing is if you caught the end of our last episode or those months ago, is that we're no longer going to be editing a video version of the podcast for various reasons, but we will be still including a version on YouTube. It'll just be the audio podcast version for those people who just prefer consuming their media on YouTube, I guess.
Yeah, that's fair. I know of at least one super fan who does listen on YouTube, so we definitely want to keep supporting those who listen that way. But, you know, we never really made a lot of efforts to edit this to be a visually appealing format anyway.
We want to play to our strengths and just focus on what we do best and save that time. As in, I am, for one, officially permanently employed once again, which of course means more money for games and various expenses. But as we all know about that seesaw, much less time. So trying to recalibrate how we spend our time on games and the podcast.
Right. Well, congrats on your employment situation. And I'm glad to be back, even though vacation is fun. It's back to life, back to reality, as the old song says. So how about we catch up? How about we catch up on, I think we promised to talk a little bit about the event that we had both attended before we left on our holiday.
Yes, that being the Vancouver Game Garden. We'd hoped to sneak in an episode on that before we left, but didn't quite get coordinated there. I don't think it's necessarily an issue because, I mean, there have already been a few changes since attending that. A few of those games have been released since then. So there's still a lot to talk about. Those games are all still relevant. And yeah, I just wanted to talk quickly through a few of our highlights from the show.
Sounds great. Yeah, I think you took better notes than I did, but we do have a little bit of overlap on the games that we played, so why don't you start us off?
Yeah, I mean, just to quickly, I guess, give a summary for those who missed the last episodes. It's basically a showcase of locally made indie games. There was something like, I want to say, 20 booths set up from various creators. Primarily people who are making games in Vancouver, but there's also some, you know, developers who have a multicultural teams, shall we say, in various cities and countries in Canada and elsewhere in the world. So this is the third year of the Game Garden, and it felt a little smaller this year, I want to say. We've got quite as many booths, a little more space to open up. The one issue for me I found is that, I mean, it very quickly filled up with people, and most of these booths can only have like one or two display PlayStations, I guess you'd call play space stations, not TM. You're often playing on the dev's like personal laptop here, and so it was hard to get a spot. And then when you do get a spot, immediately feel anxiety that I'm taking up space that someone else could be playing. So I generally only played for like 5 to 10 minutes and before moving on, and played through about 8 to 10 games, I want to say, before it just got too packed to be able to make much dent there.
Yeah, I think in terms of the spacing and size of the show, I think actually it was a little bit more comfortable, at least physically speaking, I know that, you know, the first one was that I attended at the Heritage Hall or whatever on Main Street here in Vancouver was very, very tiny and packed to the rafters and very, very hard to squeeze about. Second year shifted to the Roundhouse, a community center in downtown Vancouver, and it was kind of equally packed and hard to navigate. You know, you personally have experience with that running the, you know, TCTC game convention there. It's an awkward space and packs out really quickly. And I feel like they spaced it out a little bit more, so it was more...
No more breathing room.
Comfortable. Yeah, you had more elbow space. You weren't physically rammed into someone's back at any given moment. So I thought it was actually just about right. Fewer games, a little bit more breathing room. And there were some familiar faces. There were some familiar games. In fact, I had since bought one of the games that was shown there last year, I guess it was. I think it was the cute one with the egg platformer where you can't jump too high. It was called Foul Damage.
That's right, yes.
By a local developer who worked on... What was
Peglin
the game?
Was the other game.
Yeah, that's right. It's like one of the devs from Peglin, I think, who worked on that. So I picked that up for the Switch.
Excellent. I mean, I've had my eye on that. I remember enjoying it last year. Yeah, but that is to say, I guess we'll jump into a couple of the quick discoveries that we found. The first game I played, or one of the first, is Marrow Marrow from Monster Moon. Apparently came out April this year, 2026. It is a VR game. So this was the first time I have strapped on a VR headset for, 10 years? The only other time being, I think, a mall, a PlayStation display at a mall had... I can't remember what it was. You were sitting in a cockpit of a ship.
PSVR?
It was one of the first games. Valkyrie something, rather? Never mind. So, that is to say, I'm very sensitive to motion sickness, so I've largely avoided VR, and so I only played a little bit here. I didn't, you know, I wasn't able to extract the full value out of this. But it's such an immediate appeal, the immersion of looking down and seeing the weapons in your hand as you're moving them around. This is a first-person perspective game, I should say. And it's basically like a parkour first-person shooter. So you're jumping around, you have a grappling hook, so you can pretty seamlessly... you know, catapult around the map, shooting pretty seamlessly. I was taking it a little slower and like standing still, shoot, then grapple. But seeing other people play it, you can like seamlessly switch between those two modes. It's not one of those games where you have to be locked into predetermined teleporting, if you know what I mean, which I know some have used in the past. This is a game just by from two devs. I believe one is based in Sweden, I want to say. But yeah, it was... really fascinating experience getting back into that. It's not going to be an option for me going forward, unfortunately. I don't have the space or the hand-eye coordination and lack of motion sickness, I guess, for VR going forward, but I can absolutely see the appeal. It's an extremely immediate, immersive experience.
Very nice. I didn't get to play that one, but I have played some VR. I do have the one of those Meta Quest boxes, and it's pretty fun, but I don't play a lot, so clearly it's not, you know, taking up my world or anything like that. I'm going to talk about a game that's further down your list because I happen to play it as well. There's a little bit of overlap between the games that we played. I'm going to talk about Boreal Tenebrae, which is a game, you know, that's pretty much up my alley. It definitely looked that way. Stylistically, it was pretty cool. It was very eye-catching, played on the, like, Sony CRT TV or whatever that it was there. And it played just fine. I'm kind of interested to see what the graphics will look like on not CRT, but they looked pretty cool and retro, kind of like PS1 styles. And essentially, this is a point-and-click adventure game played in like the third person, and you know, like that PS1 style, like there's a lot of fixed camera angles, and then like you swap as you cross over onto the screen and things like that. And, you know, along the lines of things that we like is a lot of, like, kind of mysterious story happening. Not everything is clear. There's some sort of, like, magical reality, perhaps.
It's set in this sort of small town, a lot of, like, weird... Like, it's not quite Twin Peaks, but sort of just small town weirdness of unreality. And there's some animal people in the game, so it's not quite... Everything's slightly off, sort of in an uncanny valley sort of way. It's playing with some analog horror aesthetics as well. And I believe some body horror going deeper into that game from what I've heard.
Right, and speaking with the creator, this is by Snot Bubbles Productions, by the way. And speaking with the creator, I don't know their name, but they were saying that this game is a little bit autobiographical, that this is like a real town or whatever that the person lived in for a while or passed through and is sharing some qualities there. So this game seems really promising. Hard to tell in that sort of space without a really sort of deep dive into it. But what I saw there looked pretty cool, seemed very atmospheric, and looks promising. I enjoyed what I played, so kind of looking forward to seeing more of Boreal Tenebrae.
Yeah, I gravitated straight to that. That actually was the first game I played because I wasn't going to give up an opportunity to play a game on a CRT monitor, especially with those aesthetics. I do just enjoy the vibes of that small town weirdness and horror. But the one thing that did confuse me is that a version of this game actually came out in 2020, Boreal Tenebrae Act 1. And Act 0, the new game, is coming out this week, when you're listening to this, July 30th. And so a prequel, I would presume. The confusing part is there's also another product on the Nintendo Switch that's just called Boreal Tenebrae, no Act nomenclature. So I believe that is just Act 1, as far as my understanding. So I actually have bought that, to try it out before the new chapter.
Right. Well, you never know with the sort of releases. They can kind of like finalize it or re-include new content. So we'll see what comes of this publisher.
Excellent. One more from me. One thing I didn't play at the Vancouver Game Garden, but I, on returning home, saw that it was all of $2 on Steam. It's currently $5, not on sale. That is Fairies Cabin in the Tangled Woods. Fairies? F-A-R-Y. But from Pear Tree Games, this came out in 2025, and it is a first-person puzzle game presented in this sort of diegetic format, something like The Witness, where you're basically approaching these puzzle panels in first-person perspective, and instead of locking in to solve those on those panels, then moving around between them in this sort of overworld. But it's a very simplified, sort of abstracted space that you're moving around in, just very sort of dark. This is surrounded by these trees, very simple pixely artwork, very chill zen vibes. But the puzzles themselves are basically these grids. You're moving nodes around these grids in order to untangle lines between them. So it starts out as sort of cat's cradle knot, and by moving the nodes you can untangle the lines, basically. And that's how you solve the puzzles. And I struggled to find much logic into how you do that, but it was incredibly cathartic experience, just like almost like a fidget toy, just gradually unraveling it, poking and prodding and clicking around it's like untangling a knot, right? It's this very primal sort of zen experience, just to relax and untangle your mind at the same time, I guess. Especially coming back from the Game Garden, being a little bit heat exhausted and tired, I really enjoyed just unwinding with that for an hour or so.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I think the general array of games products that are at the Game Garden are really interesting, kind of representative of a bunch of different genres, and like very much like indies. Like some people are clearly following trends, and then some people are trying to subvert them and go in their own direction. So it's fun to see where some of these games go, where they're coming from as well. Another game that was I had my eye on and I knew about before we attended the show that you and I both played is one that I actually backed previously on a crowdfunding platform before it got canceled. So I was very, very happy to see that this game still has life. Speaking of, this game is called Monster Hearts Welcome to Drowned Lake. So very glad that it still has life. This game, if you're familiar with TTRPG space, is based on a TTRPG called Monster Hearts. I think it's a Powered by the Apocalypse game, which I personally haven't played, but I've listened to a couple podcasts doing actual plays. And this game is not a TTRPG. Well, not in a direct sense. It's kind of like card-based, isn't it?
It's I guess, a deck-building game, where you have a deck of cards that are representing parts of your character. You sort of create a character at the start, and you'll have cards like never been kissed, or you have an edgy look, or you're abandoned by your parents, or something like that. And so each of these cards represents some splinter of your psyche, I guess. And each one has several attributes associated with it. I think there's like four attributes. I can't remember what they're called, but like sort of might be an aggression or a seduction or a sort of witchy attributes. And you're basically going through a visual novel, and depending on your choices, you'll be presented with attribute checks, and you have to try and play enough cards to overcome that check. There will be somewhat of a random card will be dealt to sort of as a modifier in addition to that. What I couldn't wrap my head around was the actual deck building phase. Like, I don't know when you draw new cards, I don't know when you add new cards to your deck, so to speak. There wasn't much tutorialization just in terms of the demo that we played. But it was definitely a compelling experience. It's a very cool sort of punk papercraft aesthetic, and going through this high school sort of very very edgy teen mystery, like sort of Riverdale with monsters going on. It seemed like a cool vibe.
Yeah, that's right along the lines of what the source material is going for. And I think the art direction looks fantastic. It's that kind of monochromatic look with splashes of color, which is always popular with a punk edgy angle. And I know that Powered by the Apocalypse games do tend to have four attributes, so I guess that aspect of it is a direct lift. But the card-based and the randomness that way is more, I guess, reminded me slightly of games like, like Gloomhaven or things like that, where you are trying to do the best you can with the cards that have been dealt to you. So, interested to see where this will go. I mean, it's combining some elements that I tend to enjoy. Visual novels, TTRPG space, and, deck-building card games. So, on paper, it sounds great. But will they execute? I'm looking forward to seeing how it turns out.
It's been a storied history on crowdfunding for this game. We've talked about it a couple of times previously. They had a cancelled Kickstarter. They were having a second Kickstarter, but then they cancelled that due to... there was some hubbub with Kickstarter about banning adult games, basically. So they moved to Backerkit, I believe. And as of recording, my understanding was there was a successfully funded campaign on Backerkit.
Very nice. Well, let's hope all the cards come up for a good hand for this game, Monster Hearts. Welcome to the Drowned Lake.
Excellent. Okay, one game that I wasn't able to play at the Game Garden again, but it was very popular. And I actually was talking to Victor Hunter, host of Acts of the Blood God podcast, one of my favorites. And he was a volunteer there and was telling me I have to try this game. So which I immediately did upon getting home. And it is actually out now as of last week. That is Desktop Explorer from Recurring Dream. Came out on 17th of July. And so this is basically another puzzle game where you're interfacing with a virtual desktop experience, like an artificial sort of interface. And it plays out something like an escape room where you're presented with, like, you're playing a game within the world of this game within a game, which is a series of puzzles presented through like desktop folders. And like, you open the first folder and it'll give you a clue as to what you need to do to solve it, which is usually interacting with various like JPEGs, note documents, various other settings. It's so many cool didactic touches. Like you go to the drop down menu in the bottom right, and you can adjust the volume and all your other options for the games in through the the settings of the artificial interface. And like, you're editing note documents by literally typing in the game, and it's all very seamless. It's not just sort of predetermined clicking around. It's lots of cool little interactive touches. Like, you're sort of connecting images together, overlapping images. And then, of course, things start getting weird with some sort of creepypasta. Like, the things start glitching out. Like, the system isn't acting like it should. That sort of unpredictable technology, horror edge. Some really cool touches there. I'm definitely going to be picking this up at some point when I get through my current backlog.
Very nice. Yeah, it's good to see these games when they eventually see the light of day and go live. Cool. All right, Daniel, what do you think? Should we move on to some more timely subjects? I know that there's been a lot of news that's happened since we went off the air with our last episode, but
Yeah, if you can smell smoke, I'm not sure if that's the wildfires or that's the game industry on fire and just giving off noxious fumes.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even want to go into depth into these subjects because it's so depressing, but, you know, just double whammy bad news from both Microsoft and Sony. It's just making me, you know, Picard, palm on forehead meme right there. So just what can I say? We've said it before. It's sad to see. Yay, games. Yay, indie games, anyways.
Yeah, I don't really want to dwell on that right now. I mean, there's so much excellent reporting out there on these various failures across the industry. So go and support your, you know, your local independent games journalism outlet if you can.
That's right. Do you have any other happy news, perhaps?
Yeah, a couple of releases that I just wanted to quickly shout out. I mean, our last episode, or one of our last, we were talking about Crow Country, which I suddenly have anxiety over whether we titled that name correctly. I think I must have called it Crow County at some point. It is Crow Country. I listened to another podcast about this and suddenly realized, did we have this wrong the entire time? Is this the Bernstein Bears? But that is what I'd completely missed in recording that is they have a new game out. SFB Games just released Mermaid Mask. This is a sequel to their previous game, Tangled Tower, which I believe was released on iOS. I'm not sure if that's also on other platforms now. Sort of a point-and-click adventure. I've got the demo lined up, but by all accounts, it's getting great reviews. So I'm really looking forward to that. And they're playing with a very different vibe to Crow Country, but... Yeah, we were both quite enthused with that game and curious to see how they approach other genres.
Yeah, I want to see more. Actually, I've been meaning to check out that Tangled Tower, so maybe I will have to look that up as well.
Excellent. Finally, a couple of crowdfunding announcements. I mean, being employed, I am able to back a few crowdfunding projects again, but continue to be a little bit cynical about the state of that industry right now and just... I am just being bombarded with information constantly from email updates and announcements and pledge managers. And it's all the illusion of being informed, to be honest, like marketing, you know, masking itself as actual information. But so I don't want to like go too deep into any one of these, just to state like as sort of game announcements of products that will be available at some point, some cool projects to shout out. One of those, Wild Sea, a game that we covered very recently, the TTRPG from Felix Isaacs and Mythworks, has another expansion, a Reach expansion, Sour Down. So Reach is being sort of the realms, locations within that game. I reading through the description, I believe this is actually going to be sort of the homeland of the spider folk. I think, Mark, you were playing one of those in the game. I can't recall the name.
The Selicrae, I believe they're called.
Yes,
the bag
hive
of spiders.
Mind skeletons. Hive mind spiders, yes. And so this seems to be largely sort of a content mini expansion. Basically, here's some new locations you can visit, some new...
Well, they are the coolest kind of heritage in that game. So it's great to hear that there's more diving into some of that meaty lore.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah. It does look to be quite a small expansion for what it's worth, but I guess the previous games will also be available as part of that if you've had trouble accessing those. One more that I've mentioned previously, Children of Time, a book series by Adrian Tchaikovsky, is getting a TTRPG that's live now on Kickstarter. Go back and listen to that previous episode if you want to know more, but it was playing with some cool ideas in terms of scales of time and basically checking in with characters over aeons, essentially, and how things evolve over very long timescales, which of course is what that book is about, and sort of evolutionary paths of other intelligent creatures. Like, are you playing as intelligent octopuses or intelligent spiders, I guess? So yeah, that's a cool looking project. And finally, a game that we covered a long time ago and has been quite unavailable for a long time is Tigris and Euphrates, that is finally having an official re-release. It has had several other alternate versions. I think it was Yellow and Yangtze. It was like the same game but with hexes instead of squares. But now finally there is actually OG vanilla Tigris and Euphrates in a new skin. Coming out from 25th Century Games. So that is live on Kickstarter with a few other sort of imported games as part of the same project.
Very cool. Great to see old games and new having newfound life. Awesome. What do you think, Daniel? Should we move into covering the games we've been playing?
Yeah, I'm sure it's been a couple of months. I'm sure there's lots to cover there. So, Mark, why don't you start us off? I don't know if you had much to talk about in terms of your trip or what you've been playing in and around that.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of part and parcel of my gaming in the last few months is didn't get a lot of time to game while I was on my trip. I was in Asia for 3 weeks, 2 weeks in Vietnam, and 1 week in Japan. So I did do a little bit of game shopping there, but not that much. I'm just going to say that I didn't really have a very concentrated plan for my summer gaming, but I did get the itch to play a little bit more retro TCG games in video form. So you know that we covered the Pokemon TCG a little while ago, and one of the ways I enjoyed playing that was through the GB Color version of that game, which was pretty solid, I thought. I gave it a good mark anyway. So I got the itch to play other TCGs, and one of the games that I actually learned how to play in video game form is a game called Yu-Gi-Oh! Which is also very popular, still running, of course. Not nearly as popular as the big kind of two or three, but is still hanging in there somehow. And I didn't realize it went so far back. It also started in Game Boy monochromatic days.
Yeah, I don't know if a lot of those got English versions, but I believe there were quite a lot of those TCG games in Japan.
A real lot. We were talking about Pokemon TCG and saying, hey, it's a shame that they didn't get later editions with newer cards. And I think you said that it did get at least one later edition, Pokemon
TCG. I think Pokemon got at least one, yeah.
But Yu-Gi-Oh! Went the entire other direction, and they basically released a new edition every year, essentially, or maybe even 6 months. So a bunch of them came out on Game Boy, Game Boy Color, and Game Boy Advance. I know all about this because I picked up the Yu-Gi-Oh! Early Days collection on Switch. So I played a bunch of the titles there. And spoiler alert is that a bunch of those old titles are bad. It's not that they don't play well. It's just that they don't even have Pokemon TCG's kind of like hint at a overworld or...
There's no framing device?
There's no framing device at all. Really, as soon as you jump into any of the first dozen or so of those games in the collection, is like, hey there, duelist. You gotta win the game by beating these five Yu-Gi-Oh! Players five times.
Do they at least teach you the game? Is there a tutorial?
Nope. It's no tutorial. There might be a tiny one, but not in the earliest ones that I played. And I played through a bunch of generations. So
this is one for the fans, then.
You gotta be a real fan to be into this. And I'll also say that really early Pokemon, I mean Yu-Gi-Oh! Gameplay mechanisms are pretty darn dry. And I guess I don't know what it was. The edition that I really enjoyed was from the PSP. So it's only then where they start to do more interesting things. Like they have these zone cards, which there can only be like one zone at a time. And it kind of flips the rules for both players. And it adds a whole nother dimension and strategy to your deck design that I feel like the early editions didn't really have. So suffice it to say, this early days collection, I'm not really feeling that I got a ton of money's worth from it. Thankfully, it was on sale, so it wasn't that big of a dip. That said, I've yet to play the very latest games in the collection, the kind of later GBA ones, so maybe they are a little bit deeper and will eventually show some of the more layers that the later PSP and Vita versions of Yu-Gi-Oh! Have done so.
Excellent. Yeah, because the anime is about the card game, right? That is like that theme is baked into that series. So it does feel a little untapped. At least in the West here, we've not seen many of that series being explored, I guess, in the card game.
Yeah, there are a couple of live mobile versions of the game, like right now. And one of those has been around for at least 5 years. And there's a pretty solid PC version as well that's out there right now. So it's not as though you can't get them nowadays. But yeah, you're right. That show has been around for a couple of decades now, I feel like. And I guess just the earliest ones were not very well represented in game form.
You think
it'd
be pretty easy to hash out some kind of framing device when it's already about that card game, right? Like, it wouldn't take much.
A little couple of very simple talking head cutscenes would have gone a long way towards giving the game a lot of personality. But when it's just choose this AI opponent head or choose this AI opponent head, it's a little bit dry, a little hard to pull yourself back in for another match.
Fair enough. Something Blue Eyes White Dragon. That's Yu-Gi-Oh, right? It's about all I can tell you about that series.
Exactly. It's like, you pulled out the card and
you activated my trap card.
My physical form is being blasted away. Exactly. All right, what did you play in the break?
Well, a lot of my spare time has been spent just casually picking away at Dragon Quest VII. I am still playing that, about 40 hours into that game now. You don't even unlock classes till about 20 hours in, which is wild. I'm enjoying it. It is a very slow burn, though. And I am enjoying the sense that it's a lot of sort of standalone vignettes. You basically visit an island, you experience the story, you move to the next island, you experience the story. Like, each of those is in and of themselves compelling. There's very little in terms of connective tissue. And even the characters you're playing as don't really say much. They are named characters, but it's kind of ciphers just traipsing from one to the next with little sense of motivation, I guess. But I am enjoying that. It's very easy just to pick away at on the handheld, I guess, while I'm watching YouTube or whatever. But I don't have much to say, to be honest. I'm still, maybe I'll tell you in another 40 hours when I finally finished that. Still picking away at some of my long-term projects, having played Castlevania 64 and working through Majora's Mask, so I'm firmly in the sort of Nintendo 64 era for those series I've been working through. Other than that, a few indie games I've been picking at and sort of dropped off pretty quickly. I've been a little more mercenary in terms of like just saying I'm done with this game, it's not working for me, moving on. I've got so many things in my backlog I want to get through, diminishing time, and just being a little more intentional about knowing when I've had enough of a game, basically. Not a lot to discuss there in that sense, to be honest. One thing I have been doing, though, is playing a lot more games with my daughter. I've discussed previously playing a lot of Pokemon with her. That has finally broken its spell. Both the TCG and Pokopia, which she'd been playing for several months. But having seen her playing through a few other games like Dogman and Bluey the Golden Pen or something, she's been getting pretty into playing like platforming games by herself, which has been great to see. But I was compelled to try and find a game that we could play together, and so what I settled on was called Popucom. This is from Hypergriff, came out in 2025, and it's basically a cooperative puzzle platformer in the vein of something like, it was the studio Hazelight who did like Split Fiction and It Takes Two. So it is designed, there is a campaign that is designed for two players to go through. It is a little more sort of abstracted. You're basically going through a series of levels that are just puzzles. There's no real story so much as to go through. This is very sort of pop punk, cutesy aesthetic, very reminiscent of something like Splatoon. You're literally splashing coloured paint at the enemy, or shooting coloured goo at the very least. It doesn't quite have the attention to detail. Like, you're not actual, there's no colour that you're splashing on the floor. There's very little interacting with the world around you in that sense. It's not quite as polished as some of those Nintendo games. But it is incredibly appealing in that you have several tools you're interacting with. You've got, like, lasers. You have shields that you can deflect lasers and use as platforms to sort of hold each other up. You've got sort of grappling hooks that you can pull things towards you and swap around with. There's quite a lot of tools you can switch between, and each of the two players can switch between two colors. Like, I might be red and yellow and my daughter will be green and blue, and there'll be various features like that. This laser is blue, so she'll have to block that while I walk past, and I have to have my red shield to block the red lasers. But we're on a moving platform, and so you have to sort of, there's a real tempo to how you're interacting with this and switching back and forth between players, responsibilities between colors. It's basically set up as a bunch of mini gauntlets. Like, you'll have this one run of, we've got to synergize these obstacles, and we have a break or a combat arena, because most of these puzzles are interspersed with some sort of combat. And that largely takes place with match three elements, which is a strange touch. Like, there's all these goo monsters that are like either like sometimes individual, sometimes towers of them, sometimes like weird homunculi of blobs of the multiple colors. And you basically have to shoot your color into them to add extra blobs to match three to pull them away. And it's a little bit over-designed, and like the match three element doesn't really add much. You're basically just shooting the colors to destroy them, largely. Like, you're not really interacting with like match three puzzles in the traditional sort of drop-down synergization sense, but it is quite satisfying. It is a little challenging, especially with the different levels of experience. My daughter not quite having the same Twitch responses as myself, but there is a lot of accessibility options. You're able to turn off friendly fire and also turn off damage entirely on a player basis. So basically, I was taking damage, but my daughter wasn't. There was one boss that was like, we have to block each other's damage, that was really getting in the way. So I ended up just turning off damage entirely. It doesn't really ruin the experience. You're still like having a lot of fun just coordinating and synergizing the various puzzles. And my daughter's really risen to the challenge and surprised me with how well she's taken to this. I'm really hoping that she's going to be ready to play some Orbitals with me when that one comes out soon.
Man, Orbitals look so hot. Like, that's the game that has been making waves for having like pixel perfect 90s anime retro cell shading going on to it. It looks pretty exciting.
Yes, yeah, that's coming out soon, I think. But yeah, I was just finally get some Popcom. It also has a whole bunch of mini games. Like, within the framing over world, hub world, there's a bunch of like arcade games that are both cooperative and competitive. Really playing with the puzzle, like those core mechanics, and sort of exploring them in some side tangents and some really clever ways. There is a 3-4 player party mode as well that I haven't messed with. But yeah, we're really having a blast with that. My daughter's like constantly, every time we sit down, oh, I want to play the hardest level. What's the hardest level we can go to right now? So she is really pushing her to try those new techniques.
Sounds pretty ambitious. That's great that you found a game that you can kind of meet in the center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, having a blast.
Awesome. Okay, so I talked about being in Asia for a while. Unfortunately, I didn't get to do a lot of game-related stuff while I was in Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam was beautiful and exciting and so eye-opening for a lot of different ways. The only game-related thing I saw there was in Hanoi briefly, just walking downtown in a very touristy area. I just stumbled upon a kind of hobby and a toy shop, and they had like tons of Western games. I didn't spend a lot of time in there just because it didn't seem to have a lot of, you know, Asian games at all. War games that I hadn't heard of, just kind of the stuff you would see around the world.
Were they in English or Vietnamese?
They're 100% in English.
Okay.
Every part of it. So I imagine that it's maybe a hard sell, just a expensive foreign hobby. I know that the general wage is not very high there. So maybe it exists more for the tourists.
Yeah, not many games get that translation. There have been some exceptions I've seen, not for Vietnamese particularly, but like I saw that Cascadia, for example, just got a Philippine version of the game, which is really cool to see some of those other cultural versions sort of crossing those boundaries there.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the last week that I was on my trip, I did, of course, break in time for some retro game hunting. Not a lot. This is mostly for my kid, and my oldest and I share interest in kind of retro stuff. So we went to a couple of different shops on a couple of different days and spent a few hours, and I only got like half a dozen games. Speaking of Dragon Quest, I got myself, since I said I didn't really enjoy the HD version, I got myself Dragon Quest 3, the original.
Cool.
I'm going to try and play that in the retro style soon enough and see if I enjoy it a little bit better. Speaking of TCGs, I got a Duel Masters game. I got a copy of Monster Hunter 4 for 3DS for like a dollar. There's a wide range of prices, but you can still find deals. For instance, I got this copy of Bravely Default for the 3DS, the original, for like less than $5 Canadian dollars. Which is a lot easier to swallow than the remake that they just pumped out.
Fairy something or other.
Yeah, for the Switch 2 or whatever for 15 times that price. And I got a few other things. I got a Gundam game and some Super Robot Wars. So really kind of just scattershot smattering of games, mostly because there's tons of games there, and if you want to spend the time, you can find them, but just hunting for games in another language, even if you can read it, is very, very tiring, especially if they're out of the box. So good luck if you don't read the language.
Speaking of Gundam, though, I have to vent for a second, because as a location here that has the traditional Japanese gacha, it's very hard to find the proper gacha that's not just the dollar store stuff. But out of the way to a proper Japanese gacha store, they had a Gundam machine. It's like, oh, cool, I'll get a robot. I managed to get the one thing that wasn't a robot. It was, in fact, just accessories for the robots. So I now have a bunch of guns and axes and shields for Gundam, but not an actual Gundam.
It's building up the tension there. You got to get into it.
Buy more.
Yeah, exactly. It's you have no choice. In terms of tabletop games that I bought, I thought I only bought one, but I bought two. So I'll show the very basic one. It's only 200 yen copy of Mahjong cards. So my wife and I have been trying to get our family into Mahjong, the 4-player tile game. The traditional game, so hopefully this will make it a little bit easier. So that was really cheap at only $2 at Daiso. And this is a game that I've actually heard about from Japanese social media. And I've since learned that it was published in North America, I think in 2019 or something like that. But it's this game called Ito. And Ito in Japanese means string. And there's a kind of like the mind style game at play here. Essentially, like, you have to like connect a concept conceptually using these numbered cards. So it's a little bit like the mind, a little bit like wavelength, I guess. I don't know if I completely understand it well myself, but you can go ahead and download the English language rules. So it's 100% playable in English as well. And I just got this rainbow edition, which has some nice, more colorful version of the artwork. I saw 3 or 4 editions of the game while I was there. So, yeah, there's still tabletop games to be found, tons of them in Japan, but I just didn't spend the time to hunt them out.
I actually just tracked down a Canadian option for ordering games from Japan and elsewhere in Asia, especially some of the Tokyo Game Show games. So I've just put an order in for some of those that I'm hoping to get to soon.
Nice, nice. Yeah, we talked to, of course, Daniel Newman a little while ago about his adventures in Japan, Tokyo Game Market, I believe it is.
Yes, right, yes.
Tokyo Game Show being the video game one.
Of course,
Game Market being the indie doujin game one. So it's cool to hear that there's a Canadian outlet for those sorts of games as well.
Any other games you want to talk about, Mark?
I have a game that I spent a little bit more time on, if that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, so the game that I spent probably most of my time on this summer, and really, it wasn't that much, it's only about a dozen hours, is a retro game that I've been meaning to get around to for a while. It originally came out in 1996 for the Super Famicom, and I don't think it ever came out in the West until more recently. And this one I played on the Switch Remake. It's called Star Ocean First Departure R. I don't know why that R is there, but it is certainly there.
For remake, I guess?
Yeah, so this is a rare sci-fi-based JRPG. Although it's only really loosely sci-fi.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I don't want to bury the lead yet.
Yeah, it's by developer Triace, which has a fairly long legacy now. This was one of their earlier titles, and it was pretty well received at the time. Interestingly enough, apparently the creators of this game series were big fans of like space adventures like Star Trek, which is, I think, like not unheard of in Japan, but definitely less popular than Star Wars, which has a big following over there. So I was excited to hear that. And ostensibly, it is that way. There's a spaceship traveling through space, and it's kind of like that episode of TNG where Picard goes down to the planet of proto-Vulcans. Do you remember that one?
I don't recall. There's a lot of Star Trek out there.
Well, essentially, there's rule in Star Trek where, like, the advanced spacefaring people are not really supposed to interfere with, like, less advanced life forms. So they wouldn't be allowed to contact us, for instance, because we don't have faster than light space travel yet. So they play with that rule a little bit. And long story short is they visit this planet, which has this kind of very lovely pastoral setting. And they encounter these people, and then kind of all heck breaks loose because there's like a disease that's spreading. And all of this is told with really kind of lovely animated anime style cutscenes. And the cutscenes, I think, were from a later edition of the game from the early 2000s that was released a previous remake on the PSP, I believe. And the animation is from Studio IG, which actually is a pretty well-known anime studio. Production IG, which was responsible for, I think, at least one of the features in the Star Wars Visions miniseries.
I did see there was some cool 2D animation in the trailer I watched for it, yeah.
Right, so like a pretty notable animation shop doing the animated cutscenes, and that later edition added fully voiced or mostly voiced voice work in English and Japanese. So there are some nice qualities to this game. And, you know, one thing that I like about this remake is that it's actually pretty faithful to the original source material. So most of the time it's in like 2D sprites, which is really, really cool to see. So a lot of the backgrounds are just kind of static 2D JPEGs or whatever. And then there's a little tiny smatterings of 3D just in the overworld, which is totally fine with me. I kind of prefer it when these remakes like don't just blow it all up for no reason. Like, just let me play this older game in the newer platform in widescreen, and that's just fine.
There can be a lot of bells and whistles that just feel like a bit of a distraction at times.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sad to report, though, that the sci-fi setting is a little bit overblown. I played about a dozen hours of this game, and maybe like 2% of it takes place in space. And the other 98% is pretty much trad JRPG Euro-influenced fantasy stuff on a planetary surface.
Yeah, I've been really looking for a good sci-fi take on the JRP genre, and there's not a lot out there, other than, I guess, Xenoblade Chronicles, I guess, does approach that. But a lot of them seem to be just using the aesthetic of sci-fi without really grappling with those themes. And, I mean, even Final Fantasy, like, it feels more sci-fi in some of the like, I guess some of the later games, like Final Fantasy 12 and things like that, have a lot more sort of tech-based things that feel more sci-fi than Star Ocean.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely like it's a spectrum, right? Like, especially in Japan, like, you know, Star Wars works so well over there because it's science fantasy, right? It doesn't get too bogged down with the science stuff. It's just about swinging swords and then defeating gross worm guys.
Even Phantasy Star, for as much as I love that, was really just a sci-fi skin over fantasy aesthetics, yeah. like Star Wars.
That's right. I mean, though we love it, though. We love spaceports and eating hamburgers to replenish your HP. So, unfortunately, this particular game, or the amount I played of it, doesn't delve too much in the sci-fi. Doesn't mean there isn't more sci-fi later. And I believe in the later edition of the series, there's been like four or five subsequent Star Ocean games, even up until fairly recently. And I think there's quite a bit more sci-fi in those from what I can tell.
You really want to be jumping between planets and a bunch of different locations to really get a sense of scale for a sci-fi game. And I guess like Phantasy Star does that to an extent, but also it can be restricted based on hardware limitations and technology, I guess. So it becomes a lot easier down the road to really explore that scale, that the grand scale of like a sci-fi opera.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of more things that are a bit bummers about this game is that the combat is pretty much not worth writing about at all. Basically, it's a really button-mashy mess, and I think it's even less effective than the Tales of games, which I already have panned largely. This is an even less enjoyable implementation of that sort of action-y, button-mashy combat, real-time combat, so I don't think that's very successful. They do one semi-promising thing with the skill system, essentially they have like a very tabletop style way to invest skill points into a range of seemingly irrelevant aspects, like things like, I think, like carrying a tune and like aesthetics and cooking. I know a lot of games have done really interesting stuff.
So with cooking. Secondary skills, I guess.
Yeah, or even like really hard to describe. There's a whole laundry list of them. There's something like 80 skills or something like that. And eventually, if you buy or invest in two or more groups of those skills, then they unlock passive boosts or even active effects that you can trigger in combat and out of combat. So it is really promising. It is very involved, and you know, someone put some thought into this, but a lot of those actions that you can do out of the gameplay, like one of them is like foraging or something like that. You just basically like tap this button and this kind of like radar effect happens, and then you're rolling the dice and you might find something. It's so dry and so uninteresting that I don't even want to use it, even though it's available to me. It seems like a waste of time. And the combat effects are powerful, but it seems like the kind of investing in those skills and then having this secondary outcome makes it a little bit like pulling your teeth a bit to get to the results. I kind of sadly think it would have been more effective if they just let you directly invest into the final results like a more traditional RPG would. So, a really nice idea. I just don't think they executed it very well.
Sounds like just very arbitrary, slightly different flavors of number go up, basically.
Yeah, that's right. They added this abstraction layer, which only makes it a little bit more frustrating. Apparently, another interesting aspect of this game is that, unlike a lot of JRPGs, this game supposedly lets you have a kind of system story-altering gameplay choices and dialogue choices, kind of like early version of Fallout New Vegas or something like that. Apparently, one of the editions of this game has like 86 different endings or something like that. So they are trying really ambitious things with this system. I personally haven't seen a lot of this because I guess I'm fairly early. Plus, it relies on this sort of private action system, which I feel like wasn't really well explained. So it promises more depth and replayability. I haven't seen it yet, so maybe this is something I'll have to revisit after I've been able to put a bit more time into it. But so far, a little bit of a ho-hum JRPG.
Do you have a sense of how long this one is?
It must be fairly long, because I put a dozen hours into it, and it doesn't seem to be coming to any sort of conclusion. There is a wide range of, you know, cute characters. There is a decent sense of, like, comedy. Like, this, a lot of the story and character interactions are fairly tongue-in-cheek, which is nice to see. A lot of games kind of end up too serious for their own britches a lot of the time. So there are positive aspects. This game looks really nice too. Unfortunately, it suffers from being a little bit too generic.
Do you have much sense as to how the other games in the series are connected? Are they all fairly standalone, or is it part of a more connected saga?
I know that the later ones are quite unrelated, but I'm not sure about 1 and 2. 2, I think, has had a more recent re-release. In fact,
Second Star, I want to say?
Second Story? In fact, I think on Steam, you can't even get the first one. I think you can only get starting from Second Story and later. So, weirdly, they're pushing a lot of the marketing push into the second one. Maybe it's just the inherently better game.
They would have re-released it again in 5 years, Mark.
There you go. That's their track record. Well, hey, lots of these games have multiple re-releases. Let's not mention Xenoblade anymore. All right, that's it for me for the game that I spend a lot of time in. How about yourself?
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, for the sake of getting a little more tabletop into today's podcast, I have been playing more games with my daughter as well. She's, as I said, having now wrapped up our Pokemon fervor, started exploring some other games in the collection. Actually, one we borrowed from the library and she immediately took to is called Dragonimo. And this is basically marketed as my first King Domino. Have you played much King Domino, Mark? Or Queen Domino?
Yeah, I've played a decent amount, actually. I think I own King Domino and I played it with my family. And I think it's actually really cute and clever. It has a decent amount of gameplay in a small package. And, you know, it's just kind of just enough depth for a family weight game.
Well, this is definitely less depth than King Domino. I mean, King Domino, I believe, if my recollection is right, it's been a couple of years, is that you're connecting these colored regions and then it's the person with the majority, like the biggest of each region gets points, right? This is much more solitaire than that, where you basically just want to make connections of matching regions and you get a little dragon egg token and you flip it over and either it's an empty shell or it's a dragon and you get a point. So there's not really much sense of like jostling for majority and it's very much solitaire. It does have that like that sense of reveal is quite strong. Like, is it going to be a dragon? And if you don't get a dragon, if you just get the egg, that actually gets you the mother dragon token, which helps break. It lets you be first player for the next round. And the last person to have gotten an egg basically becomes first person next round. It's a very organic way of sort of subtly cycling that first person token. That was rather clever for a very simple game, I thought. And it's not like, it's nothing particularly deep here, but it is a great introduction to just the use of dominoes, I guess, and selecting which tile is going to be optimal. Like, I'm not going to say this is revolutionary. I think my daughter is probably ready for just regular King Domino. I'll see if I can get my hands on that from the library sometime soon. But she had a blast. It's very colorful. Like, it's like something like 30 different dragons that all have unique art. It's got a lot of character to it. But I guess we all know that one of those dragons grows up to terrorize the land in regular King Domino.
Speaking of, you can just borrow the regular King Domino from me if you want to try it out.
Excellent. Yeah, I'd like to do that sometime. You can bring it with you next time and we'll try it together.
Very nice. Yeah, we have a bunch of games we need to catch up on, it sounds like, and we'll do that very soon.
Yes, yeah. Well, one other game I did play that I forgot to look up, I think had won Spiel des Jahres or one of the big awards last year. This is called Toy Battle, designed by Paolo Mori and Alessandro Zucchini. It's basically a two-player war game, which is definitely on the other end of the spectrum of, like, this is direct zero-sum, take that, like, direct conflict game. Basically, you have a grid of a map. Basically, it's a bit of a capture the fortress. Like, you basically have this grid of nodes, and you need to place soldiers along these nodes to get to the enemy's fortress. As soon as you place the enemy in their fortress, you win. And there's a couple of different ways you can win by, like, if you surround these zones, you get points, and you can either race the points or capture the fortress. So there's a bit of a push and pull, multiple layers there. My daughter hasn't quite gotten the nuance of that. Generally, it's just beeline straight for the end game. So I'm trying to teach her some strategy. It's a little bit tricky. There is some randomness comes into it, though, with different unit types. Like, is, I'm trying to think, 8? Unit types, I want to say, like numbered 1 through 7, and then the Joker. They each have unique abilities. Like, one might let you draw new units out of the bag, one might let you remove units from the board, and the way you combo those obviously is going to help give you an edge. There is some luck as to when they come out at the right time, which I think for a kids game does help a lot, like as opposed to something like chess. It's going to level the playing field a little bit, at least. Or I can blame bad luck when I lose to my 7-year-old. And she does win a couple of games. I've been playing fairly conservatively, like just to keep it close. But I did come home from school to learn that she'd spent half the day practicing the game solo, just playing against herself, and she proceeded to win like 2 games in a row. So there's definitely an improvement there. And there's like, it's 8 maps. We've only played on 1 map, and it's 8 maps in the box to play. So lots to explore. I do feel like this is ripe for expansions in terms of here's a new faction with new abilities. But right now in that base box, it's just each side has the same abilities, which I think is good for a kid's game, so we both know what each other are capable of, I think is a good starting point for this kind of game.
Well, that's a really promising family game. Actually, it's been nothing but family game recommendations, it feels like, this episode.
So it's going to be a lot of that for the next little while, I think. Summer break, I've just been making more use of spending time with the family. And hey, one thing I will say, I've been letting my daughter join in on sort of regular game night with my friends, and she started to play some more advanced games. My Island, we're a little, like, four sessions into that, and she's cottoned onto that really quickly, which is a great sort of introductory, sort of start simple and then gradually layers on mechanics, which is a great option for kids, obviously. And what else did we play? Quacks was a real hit. So looking forward to start introducing her to some more advanced games.
Yep, Quacks is always popular when it comes out. All right, Daniel, what do you think? Should we move on to our dessert topic?
Yeah, I think we'll keep it relatively short as we ease back into the routine here.
Sure. Do you want to start or shall I?
You go ahead. I've got to warm myself up a bit before I go on a tirade.
Okay, great. I won't speak too long about this, I don't think. But I have a tradition. When I go on vacation, I like to read a book about where I'm going to. Last year, I got that Tokyo Vice, I think we talked about.
That's right.
So this year, I actually read two books on the subject of Vietnam, and the second one was about Vietnam and Japan. So I'll talk about the second one first, because it's a little bit longer. The book I read is a novel. It's called Twilight Territory, and it's by author Andrew X. Pham. And interestingly enough, it's about a period in Vietnamese history and world history I didn't know a lot about. It's entirely set in Vietnam, and it starts from before World War II, so it's kind of like still French colonial period. They still call it Indochina then. And it spans quite a long time, all the way throughout World War II and even the years following. And it's essentially a love story between a single mother, a divorced single mother from Vietnam, from a small village in Vietnam, and a Japanese imperial major in their colonial force. And basically, like, France, Japan, Vietnam, France, Japan, Vietnam, the contentions between those three powers are, like, undulating all throughout this novel and, of course, the historic period in which it's covering, because it's just been a hotbed of colonial powers. And even the British get in there for part of the story, too. So
They're always getting in everywhere.
Yeah.
Can't get that scene out.
They're the grandmasters of colonialism, so they have to get their bit in there. Anyways, I won't delve too deep into it because it's a fairly involved story, but I thought it was interesting for a number of different ways. It's an unlikely love story. In fact,
it's like hashtag enemy to lovers for the book talkers out there.
Yeah, well, certainly, definitely, you as a Vietnamese being colonialized by the French for so many decades, you wouldn't immediately jump into the arms of your next colonizing force. But there you go. The story, the mother, Tuyet, is very, you know, resistant to it. And they don't, you know, cut any corners. They work on the relationship, and it builds naturally, and it sort of culminates in a very happy place. Like, they make a great family, and actually the story covers not just those two, but various people in their lives. Tuyet's aunt, who is kind of a surrogate mother to her, is a very powerful, central figure in this story as well. And not just that, but there are, you know, like, neighbors in her village that she comes into. Basically, the long and short of it is that it's a very kind of like Buddhist, conceptually. And Buddhism is like a very central and evident plot point in the story, but karma is too. So karma is kind of woven into the story, and I know a little bit about it, but not nearly as much as some. But the concepts of karma are really interesting. Japanese look at it from a certain perspective, and Vietnamese look at it from another perspective as well. And there's corollaries to, you know, Christianity as well. You know, there's, you know, you do good in the world, and you get good in the afterlife, and that sort of thing. And those concepts are woven in there. But in this story, it's a lot of hardship that the characters go through, and a lot of coming together of community and family and kind of surrogate family. In hard times, you know, people have to come together and stand up for each other against, you know, antagonizing forces, against injustice. And basically, this the main character, Tuyet, she is kind of like this kind of like semi like mystical character. Like, she has the power of premonition, it seems. It doesn't largely play like into delving into like a fantasy story. The story is very grounded, but she kind of, her superpower is that she can give and not ask for anything in return, and then karma will give her the thing she needs when the time comes.
Is it just in the sense of how people internalize their own story about their lives, I guess?
Yeah, it's hard to say because it's a fiction, obviously. Mm. These aren't real people, or maybe they're based on events of the author's distant relations or something like that. But it's interesting to see like a realistic, grounded story, but told through the lens of Buddhism, because quite often, you know, fiction, especially fiction in English, is told through the lens of Christianity or Catholicism.
The default, right?
Exactly. Like, yeah. those kind of archetypes, those sort of standards are woven into so much of Western fiction. So it was really, actually really cool to see kind of two protagonists that are Asian, but they're not from the same culture. So they have to come to terms with each other's cultural differences as well. And, you know, one is a colonized people and one is a colonizer. So it was also interesting to see that from a non-European perspective, even though the legacy of French and British colonialism is also very powerful in this story.
Sounds like it's tackling some pretty heavy themes and sort of historical context rather than just cozy romance for the sake of it.
Certainly, no. This isn't a light summer romance that I wouldn't recommend it if that's what you're looking for. Now, one thing I will caution about this story is that, you know, I could give whatever spoiler alerts or whatnot, but there's lots to trigger one. There's lots of dark places this story goes to. And it goes to so many dark places that I sort of felt like it was a little much at times. And I felt like it just got to so many dark places that it sort of felt a little bit excessive, like almost like torture porn.
Fetishization
of suffering. Yeah. It's just like, hey guys, you thought you had it bad last chapter. How about a little bit more? So I felt a little bit, it was a little bit hard to get through, but I think in the end it was worth it. It doesn't have a simple answer, but the story concludes and it felt kind of like a poetic ending to a really kind of effectively told story. The descriptions are very colorful, but also like a lot of other, I don't know, Asian novels that I've read, is a very kind of like brief descriptions of things. Like, they don't over-exaggerate. And I think this Andrew X. Pham is not writing in Vietnamese and translating in English. I think this is an English language novel. So, you know, he potentially has, you know, some, you know, multitudes to him as well. You know, he's coming from the story matter from different perspectives. So I thought it was a fascinating story, really worth reading if you're a history buff or are just fascinated about learning about a new perspective. I learned about Vietnam is that there's a lot of history there, there's a lot of struggle there, and a lot of pain there, but also a lot of perseverance and a lot of creativity and endurance, and that it's definitely a cultural force, you know, that should be known more about. So I'm glad I learned a little bit more about it. The other story I read briefly, I actually listened to in audiobook form as a bit of a Canadian connection, is a memoir called V by author Kim Tui, who I believe wrote the memoir originally in French because she learned French in Vietnam and then emigrated to Canada, to French Canada, and has obviously since become a cultural force, author. And I thought that was a powerful story as well, learning about the perspective of like the Vietnam War from kind of an insider, someone who was actually there and lived through it and was telling her parents' story and her story of coming over here and becoming accustomed to Canada and the culture shock of that. So very touching and impactful to me as an immigrant. And it was cool to learn about that side of Vietnam as well.
Yeah, it can be hard to know how sort of accurate a lot of some of these books are, but it can definitely at least expose our own ignorance and sort of open up the possibility of wanting to know more about these spaces. I remember like reading, for example, Babel, which is about set during the Opium Wars, which really made me want to read up more on that segment of history. So even with these very fictionalized, exaggerated versions of history can be quite enlightening in a way.
Yeah, it's always hard to tell whether, you know, with these stories set far away, quote unquote, how accurate it is. But, you know, like, does a story need to say everything about a culture if it's set there? You know, some stories are sort of universal, like love stories and wartime and suffering, you know, colonization. Like, these are universal themes. It can reveal stuff, but it also kind of reveals the universality of human struggle and things like that as well. So yeah, it's cool to see stories written with that kind of direct authorship. Is like, yeah, I've been there, I know this is my people, whatever I'm telling about, you know, my background as the author. It's cool to see.
Awesome. Well, I'd love to hear more about your trip off the air sometime.
For sure.
What you saw there. Excellent. Well, a very different tone of book that I have today. And I mean, I usually like to keep this segment a little positive about things that we've enjoyed. But there's a series of books that I've been noticing have gradually been colonizing the book channel of every Discord server I'm in. And I had a sense that this was not for me, but I just had to know what the deal was and sort of have a feel for that zeitgeist and be a part of that cultural moment. This is, of course, Dungeon Crawler Carl, the lit RPG series by Matt Dinneman. Mark, are you at all familiar with this?
Yeah, I've definitely heard the name. I mean, it kind of intersects with a couple of different things I'm interested in.
Like isekai or portal fiction. I've seen a lot of discussions on the taxonomy of what exactly lit RPG or where this series falls into it.
Right. Lit RPG is also a genre that I've heard bandied about, but I don't have a lot of direct experience with. So it's on my list. I haven't read it. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't recommend it for one thing, other than the fact that it's a very easy read. I sped through this in a week. I mean, these are long books. I'm a slow reader, all things considered, but I did speed through this. It's a very Moorish book of just constantly beat by beat. This thing happens and this thing happens and this thing happens. Compared to, like, I'm reading through Lord of the Rings at the moment. That is an incredibly dense book that is still hard to get through, where the prose is sort of changing page by page and the flow is you have to really be paying attention, whereas this is just like junk food, just get it in there and burn through. And it's very satisfying to have said, oh, I read this whole book in 2 days, right? Like, I'm sure a lot of people get a lot of satisfaction in that sense. I do find it extremely empty calories in just the sense that it's just intolerable sense of humor. It's just, it mistakes like pop cultural references and just insincerity as humor, right? It's trying to be a satire of both RPGs, but also like a bit of a dystopian Hitchhiker's Guide for the Galaxy story. It's basically the world has been destroyed by aliens and the whole surface of the world, underground of the world, has been turned into a giant, like one giant dungeon that's now an alien reality TV show, and people are being like, the few people who survive are now having to go through the dungeon and basically funneled down into more and more difficult levels as they get deeper. And you see the number plummeting over the course of the series, I guess. And like that seems to be the main sense of pathos, because people are like, it's a horror story. But that is, at least from what I've seen so far, that is mostly represented by watching this number goes down of like how many humans are left alive. And there's no time like left to linger on that or actually sort of feel that number. It's just constantly moving on to the next thing, right? Like, watching number go up or number go down as he gets more powerful, like that's just the main sense of emotional resonance in this. And everyone says, oh, it gets better after book 5, which I think is just an absurd recommendation. And I do think a lot of people have sort of internalized like their feelings on the whole series and sort of applied that to all of the books. Like, there's a lot of excuses for this first book based on people's love for the later books. This series has reached this sort of critical mass of fandom that makes it very hard to criticize, with people getting quite upset about that, obviously. So, look, I don't think it needs its defenders. It's very popular, but I found it pretty rough to get through. And just, like, there's a lot of offensive moments. Like, the aliens are, you know, play up human stereotypes. Like, there's one of the bosses he fights is basically a stereotype of a Latino hoarder. It was like cockroaches spilling out of their mouth and just covered in garbage and just really offensive stereotypes. And I see people say, oh, but it's supposed to be offensive. And I don't think that really understands what satire is supposed to be. It's like the South Park form of satire where you're trying to, some part of you is just enjoying it being offensive. It's not actually saying anything interesting about that state, if you know what I mean, other than just constantly repeating stereotypes. You're just repeating those rather than actually challenging them in an interesting way. And like there's the AI in this is basically has this really edgy meme lord sense of humor and a foot fetish, and every time there's an achievement in game or an announcement, it's through this voice of the AI, and it's supposed to be funny. How annoying and obnoxious it is, but you have to read it over and over and over and over again, and it's just, I've seen one reviewer compare it to Temu Claptrap, which feels pretty on the ball, and it's just forcing you to read obnoxious things. Like, it isn't funny. It's just, I get the joke. It's just terrible. I don't know. I might continue reading it just to hate read it. I saw a comment recently that you need to be a hater as much as a lover to really appreciate media. And just to be part of this, again, cultural zeitgeist and what the obsession is with this, we'll see.
Yep. Hate it or love it, as long as you buy it, right?
Well, I'm getting it from the library, but definitely, because I'm not spending money on this.
Nice. One thing I will say is very 100% accurate for isekai is that I am reading one isekai series that I got through Humble Bundle. Is one called Am I Actually the Strongest? Are you familiar with this one at all?
No.
It's pretty much every isekai. I don't have to say much because it is just that. It has no depth. It's just empty calories, and it's just kind of plot. It's just like thing happen, and obviously power fantasies are all involved there, but there's just like no nuance whatsoever, but you still want to keep reading because like they just keep shoving those empty calories down your throat. So it sounds like Dungeon Crawler Carl has really learned at least that lesson of writing isekai well.
It's the same thing that compels people to keep playing MMOs, right? That mini hit of dopamine that is constantly pushing you forward. I mean, I'm reminded of having watched a few anime. I talked about Shangri-La Frontier, which is one that I really enjoyed because it's set in an MMO, but that's not really the focus. Like that's just the backdrop to the character motivation. So you need to care about the characters as much as the game itself, compared to something like Solo Leveling, which I bounced right off of because it was just completely obsessed with the nitty-gritty of the achievements and each individual buff that the character gets and the plus 2.5%. And that's not the interesting part of this. I mean, for some it is, obviously, but like it does not do anything for me.
Yeah, isekais are a real outlet for some weird pseudo-game designer's perverse little tweaks.
And it can be cool, just like the actual discussion of game design can be really fascinating. I remember watching Westworld and really wanting to know more, what's the game design of this place? And they, of course, quickly move beyond that, which is like to its benefit generally. Like there is some cool sense of game design here, but it's generally just as throwaway as a joke in Dungeon Crawler Carl rather than actual meaningful thinking about how this would work in the real world.
Well, I'll probably end up punishing myself and reading it anyway, and we can compare more notes then.
Excellent. Let's do that.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad to be back. And it sounds like we're going to be having some interesting conversations, maybe with some guests in the future. Not sure if it'll be next episode, but we'll have some fun talks.
Trying to be a little firmer with scheduling in advance right now, what shall we say?
Sure. Sounds good. And we are... I'm going to be shaking things up a little bit technically anyways. You listeners don't really need to know about that, but if there are potentially a couple of delays, it might be related to that, but we're figuring it out.
Yes, stay tuned. Obviously, you can follow us on Blue Sky to find more information there as new episodes and any changes come out. You can find the podcast there at Omni Gamers Club, and myself, I'm there at Board Game Feast.
That's right, and we're still putting episodes out on YouTube. They'll just be a different format, more in the audio only format for our listeners there. So please continue to support us.
The podcast tab in YouTube now, I'm not entirely sure how that works. It's a little confusing.
Yeah, we're figuring out the technology there. So ultimately, we would love it if you could support us through commenting, sharing, just, you know, share the podcast with someone you think might enjoy it, because we do this for the love, and we'd love to hear the feedback that you have to give.
Always appreciate it. If you people joining the club and helping to spread the word, and if you have any questions or comments on today's episode, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Daniel. It's good to be back. And let's talk again really soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Mark. Welcome back. And remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.